Welcome back to part two. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian, featuring Pitbull. We're covering Jennifer Lopez, the good and the bad.
Yeah, so we looked at Out of Sight and had a bit of a... But let's launch straight in and say that the film we're doing today for the bad part of Jennifer Lopez's career is also definitely a low light for Jane Fonda's career, which is Monster in Law. Now, it is undeniably bad, let's be honest, but Brian, you and I have a lot to say about this film because we were entertained.
Were we, though?
Were we?
In the intervening years since we last left Miss Lopez, she was kind of riding on a career high, Out of Sight. She kind of fell down that trap that I think happened to a lot of women in those years of being saddled in really crappy rom-coms.
It's the early 2000s, that cultural wasteland I draw attention to regularly here.
Now I'm just going to take a moment to stand on my soapbox and say... You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who loves a rom-com as much as I do. I have such respect for this genre, which makes me so annoyed at the kind of cookie-cutter, dreadful, frankly, anti-woman type of rom-coms that came out, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, kind of exemplified by those awful Kate Hudson, Katherine Heigl vehicles.
Ugh.
And poor Jennifer Lopez, who had been so strong and so tough.
Fighting snakes, left, right, and center.
Snakes of all kinds and criminals. Here she is, you know, in things like The Wedding Planner, which I know is a hit, and things like Made in Manhattan, which I don't think was a hit.
No, it was a hit.
Was it a hit?
Yeah.
Okay, anyway. Certainly not necessarily using her as best she can. And then here along comes this project, Monster in Law. I can distinctly remember the buzz and the hype leading up to Monster in Law. It was because legendary two-time Academy Award winner Jane Fonda was coming home to our movie screens. She was no longer going to be working out and hanging out with Ted Turner and CNN. She was going to be back where she belonged on the big screen. And frankly, what a letdown.
All right, everybody, are you ready to make the movie?
Sean, I feel like, particularly having listened to the most recent You Must Remember This series of Jean and Jane, you have a newfound appreciation for Jane Fonda?
I have an immense appreciation for Jane Fonda. Now, there is something about her ferocious intensity and inability to relax on screen that I just... I'm heartened by it. I am warmed by it. I'm nourished by it.
No one commits to anything quite to the extent that Jane Fonda does.
She makes me want to be better in my job, in my friendships, in my relationships, even just sitting down reading a book.
She makes me want to be really committed to any 24-hour dance marathon that might end in death. Do you think Monster in Law was a poorly conceived comeback vehicle for Jane Fonda, or was there potential here?
No, it was poorly conceived, Brian.
Couldn't you imagine this being a fun film? Do you remember the trailer and the like hype for this movie?
Yeah, I do, and I remember being, what, this is 2004, I remember being 15 and thinking to myself, this marketing campaign is terrible. The clips they use in the TV spot constantly was that kind of like dream-ish sequence where the Jane Fonda character hears bad news and then is, like, slamming her daughter-in-law-to-be's face into, like, the cake they're eating.
What is wrong with that? That's great.
No, because, you know, even at that age, I was like, this is pitting two women against each other over a man, which I think is always a bit of a toxic setup for
okay,
a movie.
Okay.
Especially when, you know, only one of them is romantically involved. It just sticks its nails into sisterhood.
Okay, yeah, that's for sure, although as someone who is a fan of All About Eve, I frankly don't think you have much ideological consistency to go on there.
They're actors, they have careers and professions.
Jane Fonda doesn't have a career and a profession in this film?
Well, actually, she doesn't.
Well, we're going to get down to who Jane Fonda is and who Jennifer Lopez is, but I guess I'm just trying to say that, like, for Jane Fonda, to decide that she was going to come back after a very long time of hiatus. What do you think she was thinking? Do you think she was thinking, oh, this'll be fun?
Well, I'm curious to know who signed on first.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's like, okay, J-Lo, we've got a great role for you. You were great in The Wedding Planner. Okay, this time you're going to be on the reverse of that. You're going to be getting married. And get this, you'll be working with...
Faye Dunaway. So who else could it have been?
She's like, pass. Like, okay,
Louise Fletcher. Who?
Well, here's the thing. She was on Deep Space Nine. She was great. This is the thing, is that, like, I'm genuinely curious as to who brokered this deal. Fair play to them. It is a Latina megastar with Hollywood royalty.
Yeah.
And also, on paper, there is something interesting that is slightly, you know, breaking the mold of what this could have been. It could have been Kate Hudson. You know, it could have been.
The trick of any romantic comedy, yeah, is the obstacle, right? So, we all know it's going to end with the boy and the girl getting together. We've seen so many of them. Mistaken identities, you know, man dressed as a woman, I've erased your memory, you know, whatever the thing is going to be, what is the new and interesting obstacle that we can make, even though the audience knows how this is all going to play out? And I have to say that, and this is why I'm sort of praising the concept, the idea that the obstacle is going to be my Gorgon-ish mother-in-law has potential, right? Because it has potential in the sense of exploring the way that your prospective partner's family dynamics and the, like, baggage that he carries, you know, in his Freudian handbag can, like, become a complication. There's definite potential. And then when you decide to make that mother-in-law not, like, a typical sort of nagging mother-in-law, mm-hmm. instead... Who is Jane Fonda? She's Viola.
Right? I keep calling her Viola Davis, but that's not her name. It's no. Like Viola something. Okay, Viola is kind of like somewhere between Barbara Walters and Barbara Streisand, you know, to be quite honest. Like, she's a TV journalist who has turned light entertainment into pure journalism. Not only does she interview, like, pop starlets, she also is familiar with the Dalai Lama, all the former presidents. She also knows the man who introduced the euro into the global market.
Honestly, they must have just had a day where the screenwriter just sat down and is like, how many... It reads a little bit like those Drew Droga, Chloe Sevigny YouTube videos where it's like...
Except with Maureen Dowd.
It's like, I've been dining with the Sultan of Brunei, Carrie Fisher, and Snoop Dogg. Like, the number of times that Jane Fonda just name drops these, like Henry Kissinger and, you know...
I was having brunch with Maureen Lipman, Maureen Dowd, and Maureen O'Hara.
So anyway, that's who Jane Fonda is. And I guess what I'm saying is, like, the choice to make her a kind of successful, powerful, first wave feminist is super interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I would be curious as to know what the original character was like.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling that Jay Fond kind of wanted to at least make that role more like who she is as well.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be said, this role makes absolutely no sense, okay? There's these elements where you're like, wow, this is an interesting character in a portrait. Like, she is super successful. She's a victim of sexism because...
And ageism.
Yeah, her ratings have dropped. She sort of has a nervous breakdown on TV because she's been kind of sidelined by the network. She's forced to interview a pop starlet who's modeled after Britney Spears, and she kind of just starts screaming things at her like, your generation doesn't even know the significance of Roe versus Wade.
So basically, you have absolutely no idea what's going on in the world. And yet you sold over 5 million albums, CDs. Millions of kids who listen to her insipid lyrics. You want to know me? Look in my makeup bag. You're influencing an entire generation of kids who won't know how to think straight, or vote for a president, or remember the significance of Roe versus Wade.
Oh, I don't support boxing as a sport. I think it's too violent.
Y'all better get that little girl out of there.
Jane Fonda, like, basically throttles her on screen and then is forced away into, like, a sanitarium where she, like, recovers. Is she a legitimate victim of sexism and ageism?
Is she a megalomaniac monster?
Is she an alcoholic? Because there's all these jokes about her, like, drinking problems.
Is she a manipulative bitch?
Is she just an insane person?
Is she misunderstood?
Yeah. There's a lot of fun that can be had with, like, larger-than-life characters. You need only look as far as, dare I say it, Miranda Priestly, to see that, like, a Gorgon role can be larger than life, and yet, with a great actress, it can also be given some form of humanity. That does not happen here.
That's a very interesting point, actually, Brian, because this film is only a few degrees away from The Devil Wears Prada, or what could have been. Come on, working for a Gorgon in a fashion magazine is not the most complicated plot in the world. Having a Gorgon as a mother-in-law is a very relatable story in lots of people's lives. It's prepackaged to be interesting.
This is what I'm saying when you're talking about, you know, challenging the sisterhood. It's not to say that tensions between daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law aren't real. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can be honest to women's experience and even kind of writing it in broad comic strokes and still have some kind of truth that's at the heart of it. The difficulties of your children moving on from being your children to being independent partners, that could be really rich comic potential.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I'm not saying that it's sexist or misogynist or anything. A film has the opportunity to take these grains of truth and make them fun and frivolous and entertaining while still shining a little light on some common experience.
Yeah, so let's just enumerate, if we can, the plot construction of this, because we've talked a lot about Jane Fonda. We haven't talked about Jennifer Lopez. Now, I think that in The Wedding Planner, at least Jennifer Lopez is allowed to be a kind of uptight career professional. In Monster-in-Law, her character is a nothing, okay?
She's a nothing, but she's an everything at the same time.
It's just so weird, midway through this highly successful woman's career, to see her playing a kind of every girl who kind of actually talks in a voice that's, like, cute and chirpy like this.
Look, I think you're a really nice guy and everything, but I don't know why you called me. I'm a woman.
Yeah, I love that fact.
Have you ever been with a woman?
Excuse me?
I mean, have you only ever been with men?
Man, what are you talking about? Whoa, wait a minute, I'm not gay.
You're not?
No, I like women. Lots of, no, not lots of women, but you know what I mean. Why did you think I was gay?
Awkward. Okay, I gotta go now.
And you're just thinking to yourself, she's doing a lot of work to, like, mask her legitimate intelligence, charisma...
Unique, determined talent.
And ballsiness in a, like, flowery sundress as a kind of woman who, like, works all these jobs as, like, a dog walker and a caterer. And you're just like, oh my god, could this character have any less distinction or roundedness to her whatsoever? Like,
yeah, we talked about edges in the first part, the soft edges. Well, they've been erased.
Could they not have found a way to make a rom-com heroine who had any form of personality? And they're taking an actress who has tons of personality, and they're actually just having her mute it down to nothing.
Well, dare I say it, Brian, because Jennifer Lopez is a Latin woman in this role, it reminds me very much about the writings of Richard Dyer, who has an amazing book called White, which talks about the various shades of whiteness and what is deemed acceptable whiteness of characters in films. By virtue of being a Latin woman, we are told to kind of guess where she is in society, okay, amongst these incredibly rich white people, okay? Mm-hmm. And therefore, she is not allowed to have any faults, discernible faults whatsoever. She overworks so much to kind of say, I am a hardworking, multi-talented, grafting, contributing member of society. So by making her this kind of perfect saccharine woman, it's kind of taking away any kind of flavor, as it were, to her character. And by virtue of her being a Latin character, you know, our perceptions of her on screen would be someone with flavor, with spice, dare I say, okay? Compared to the vanilla cream, you know, cinnamon-scented candle of Jane Fonda and her people. So she has to be perfect. If she was in any way more exotic, in inverted commas, she would be more antagonistic than Jane Fonda.
I think I get what you're saying, and it's as if she wouldn't be allowed to have any legit reaction to this that would, like, might make the audience somehow less sympathetic to this kind of doe-eyed, sugar-coated non-person that
and also,
we see.
Isn't she an orphan? Like, are her parents dead?
Yes, her parents are dead, and her dad has given her, like, wonderful advice, and she's, like, totally optimistic all the time.
Yeah, so she has no family background for us to ever scrutinize or be interested in.
Yeah. But this is the thing about the way that the movie was sold at the time as a kind of knockout bout between J-Lo and Jane Fonda. Like, that movie I would actually kind of really like to see in a way, but the movie that we get, like, consistently does not allow us to get that kind of toe-to-toe battle. It waits for a very, very long time where poor put-upon J-Lo just kind of shrugs her shoulders and rolls her eyes and kind of
mutters under her breath at best.
And makes doe eyes at a romantic lead who, like, frankly, I don't even know who that actor was, and I don't even have any interest in looking up his name on Wikipedia.
I'm sorry, whoever you are.
Can you just sort of describe him? So he's like a... She meets him, she's doing one of her mini dog walking jobs, isn't she, on the beach, and he, like, jogs by shirtless, and then the next day or that night she's doing another job catering at an affair with her friend's catering agency, and there he is.
Well, you know the way we compared this to The Devil Wears Prada, okay? Uh-huh. He's like a low-rent Simon Baker, if that's even possible.
He's also, like, skinnier and just sort of interchangeable with Simon Baker. He is, like, a blonde, personality-less
plank of wood.
And he's not even hunky. Like, you could think at least they would get somebody who would, like, arouse a boner.
I found it very difficult to point him out on screen when he was there.
He just literally, like, faded into the off-white cream wallpaper. Yeah. So he's dreadful, so there's absolutely no motivation for their marriage. And frankly, he also does the world's worst thing in terms of proposing. Yeah? So he and J-Lo are getting their relationship growing and growing, and then
they meet mom for the first time.
In comes monster-in-law Viola, played by Jane Fonda, and we get her comic introduction, and then she meets J-Lo for the first time. Of course she's horrified and she's dropping Henry Kissinger's name, and then what does nameless interchangeable twink hunk do?
He proposes marriage in front of his mother.
I mean, honestly, ladies, men, anyone, if someone puts you on the spot and pops the question, frankly, in front of anyone,
I would pop off. That's what I do.
Oh, my God.
Charlie, will you marry me?
It's too sudden. She's in shock.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, I am, but... Seriously?
No. Say no.
Yes. Yeah.
But of course she views it as romantic, and then they're all set to, like, get married. And this is where we get into the long extended middle section. In theory, it's supposed to be this amazing comedy where Jane Fonda, like, keeps coming up with more Baroque ways to try and destroy the sanity of Jennifer Lopez.
I'm sorry, I thought it was air freshener.
It just strains our own credulity and our, like, patience.
Well, and that's why the film is false advertising, basically, because it's not bride wars or mother-in-law, daughter-in-law wars. It's just Jane Fonda being obnoxious and insane for, you know, 95% of the film. And that's actually not very entertaining.
Can we just enumerate some of the things she does? So, First of all, she just tries to be really bitchy. Then she decides, okay, I'm gonna create this elaborate, like, gaslighting scheme where I'm gonna hire all these people to make it seem like I've had an anxiety attack. She literally, like, pays someone to play a therapist who says that she needs to move in with J-Lo and her son. And then while she's moved into the house, she, like, totally out Charles Boyer by, like, doing all these things to, like, drive J-Lo insane, culminating in a, like, late night appearance where she's dressed in a, like, kabuki gown that she claims she got from Chairman Mao, which looks like she's the fucking Babadook, like, appearing to, like, freak the fuck out of J-Lo.
I couldn't sleep. Hmm? What do you think of my outfit? This is a ceremonial robe given to me by Chairman Mao. These go with a robe. This was a birthday gift from the Dalai Lama.
And doesn't she drug her at one point, and she serves her all kinds of terrible food, like a steak and kidney pie that's primarily made of kidney,
which
and all this stuff.
Which I would think is delicious, to be honest.
Yes, yes. None of this totally works, and it just hardens J-Lo more and more. And when she finally realizes, for instance, that this whole anxiety attack plotline is all an elaborate ruse, she sort of declares war. But by this point, we're nearly 25 minutes into the end of the film.
It's hardly war, she declares. It's more like, okay, I'm going to at least push back at this nonsense. Like, it's really underwhelming.
The kind of biggest sight gags occur, like, in the rehearsal dinner, where Jane Fonda, in a last-ditch attempt to really sabotage the wedding, grinds up some almonds and puts them into the gravy because J-Lo has acknowledged that she's allergic to nuts and it will make her face swell up. And Wanda Sykes...
Who's also in this, by the way.
Yes, as Jane Fonda's personal assistant is like, don't put the nuts in the thing. And then she, like, literally whacks Wanda Sykes, and Wanda Sykes responds by saying, you just dislocated my vagina.
Hey, that was a fun line. You know, this is the first film I've ever seen Wanda Sykes in.
Yeah, and
isn't,
I mean,
she always kind of the best friend, as
well,
it were?
Well, she's like a wisecracking character, but it is also, like, frankly a bit uncomfortable that she just has this, like, fealty to Jane Fonda, even though she, like, completely disagrees with everything that Jane Fonda does. And she, like, sits on the side and, like, makes, like, wisecracks about, like, how Jane Fonda is just, like, an overgrown weather girl who drinks red wine out of a box.
No, it's not unlike, you know, Mr. Renfield's relationship with Count Dracula, I would say. You know?
That's totally what I was thinking of. But anyway, so J-Lo does end up eating the almond-spiked gravy. You know, hilarious sight gag. Her, like, lips blow up to, like, the size of Amanda Lepore, and...
Or the late Pete Burns.
But only for about 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's the day before the wedding, and she's, like, there whimpering, like, she can barely talk, her tongue is engorged, and her like, lips are like Barbara Hershey, you know, times 12. And then the next morning she wakes up and it's gone. And it's like, what a waste of a gag.
And you know what else, though? I was waiting for them to be like, oh, well, you know, at least you got a little bit of extra plumpness for the big day. You know what I mean? You got a slight lip enhancement still there.
Well, there are a bunch of plastic surgery jokes at the expense of Jane Fonda, repeatedly.
A few,
things,
yeah,
like, if it ain't broke, fix it before it gets broke. And then there are a bunch of butt jokes at the expense of J-Lo. Like, Jane Fonda, like, somehow tailors her dress so it's going to emphasize her, you know, her hips. Or then when she's talking about the swollen lips, Wanda Sykes is like, it's going to make her whole throat, like, swell up. She's like, I guess it'll match her other body parts, you know? But it just falls flat.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, you keep saying to yourself, how is this going to ever be resolved in any kind of semi-satisfying way? And there's three words in the credits that you, Sean, is a very clever, you know, watcher of film. You kind of knew where this was going. And those three words in the credits were... And Elaine Stritch.
Yeah.
As soon as we saw that, you knew where this was headed,
well,
didn't you?
Yeah, well, first of all, we had to suffer through the first 85 minutes of the film. And then we realized it's the big day. Is who has to walk in is Elaine Stritch. And Brian was like, she can't be old enough to be Jane's mother. And I was like, no, but she could be old enough to be Jane's mother-in-law.
Now, I have to say, this is a very tired trope because it kind of recreates exactly the structure of revelation that concludes Postcards from the Edge, right?
A little bit.
I mean, the idea from Postcards from the Edge, right, is that Meryl has such a hard time with her domineering mother, Shirley MacLaine, but then late in the film, in comes Mary Wicks as the domineering mother of Shirley MacLaine, and Meryl kind of sees, oh, this cycle of, you know, emotional baggage is just being repeated again and again.
The difference is that in Postcards from the Edge, they've already reconciled by the time they realize this part, okay? Whereas in this, it's always a bit lame to bring in a character in the last 2 minutes of a picture to tie everything up and then disappear again.
Well, so who, just in case we haven't figured it out, who is Elaine Stritch?
She's the mother-in-law of Jane.
Yeah, and her name is Gertrude, and she's, you know,
indomitable.
She's done all the same terrible things to Jane Fonda when Jane Fonda married her son that Jane has been doing to J-Lo. And actually, Elaine Stritch has a brilliant line reading when she takes a gander of Jennifer Lopez and she says, well, I guess my grandson has found himself an exotic Latina to marry. Leave it to a Broadway baby to really sell a line like that.
But can I at least give this film credit for acknowledging that she is a Latin woman? This is another complete fallacy the entire time. I'm not obsessed with the racial politics of this. It's just that in the USA, which we know to be more divided than ever, would that not have come up in any conversation about who her son is marrying?
Instead, she says things like, she's a dog-walking slut.
Yeah, stupid things like that.
So then, after all of this tension and, like, literally mommy dearest level of insanity, it all gets resolved because somehow Jane Fonda's character is like, oh yeah, I didn't like my mother-in-law either. So on the day of the wedding, this one interaction with Elaine Stritch prompts Jane to, like, suddenly have a complete change of heart and, like, pull Jennifer Lopez aside and be like, I want to be a good person now. This is the part that just felt the most flat of anything.
Yeah, basically because we're waiting so long for this war to really start, and by the time it does, it's over and resolved.
There is that kind of one bit where they just slap each other. Do you remember that? I think J-Lo slaps her first and then says, oh, I'm sorry. And then Jane Fonda says something like, you don't slap someone and apologize. Why don't you get some backbone? And then they just, like, whack each other.
But, you know, it's that kind of slap where it's literally the head turning from left to right. Do you know what I mean? Their shoulders don't move. Their chest doesn't move. Like, their elbow. Nothing moves. Do you know what I mean? I can't do it now because the microphone. But it would be just like...
Sean would demonstrate it on me, you know,
yeah,
very, very definitely, if this were a video.
Oh, yes. Multiple takes. You know, I was in a short film once where I had to be smacked. Uh-huh. And it took about 20 takes. And my friend Connor, who directed it, he said they did a super cut for themselves of me getting slapped in the face, like, over and over again.
But anyway, 30 seconds after this, like, slap fest, Jane is just, like, going all, you know, on Golden Pond tearful about how she, like, doesn't want to be excluded from their lives, and she's only, you know, been insecure because her son is growing up, and, like, can she still be a part of their lives when they have children? And then J-Lo is like, I want you to come to every clarinet recital and soccer practice and every holiday, and I want you to be there, no question. And you're just like, where did all this come from?
Yeah, and you know what? By the time Elaine Stritch shows up, I had seen how much was left in the film. It's like 8 minutes, and I was like, okay, 4 minutes of this is credits. They fight, they make up, and they conclude in the next 4 minutes. That's how rushed it feels.
Sad, sad, sad. Pitch for me, Sean, the J-Lo J-Fo vehicle that would actually use these two stars' potential to better advantage.
Okay, so Jane Fonda is a tireless anti-war campaigner. Jennifer Lopez is a high-ranking Latina military official. The two of them are sent to a conference in South Vietnam. Okay.
What year is this?
This is 2017, okay? There's a storm and they're grounded, okay? The action takes place in the hotel suite where the two of them are placed for 2.5 hours. What do you think?
It sounds
single
more,
take.
It sounds more like a two-woman play. I think I've just had a revelation. It's the Teresa Hines Carey biopic.
Oh!
Jane Fonda is Teresa Hines Carey, and J-Lo is her personal assistant who's realizing that maybe Teresa is, like, you know, losing it a bit, and John Kerry is off trying to broker the Iran deal. Mm. And so J-Lo starts interviewing her about her life and her political career, but at the same time, Jane/Teresa takes an interest in Jennifer Lopez's own hardscrabble life as a single mother in a Washington, D.C. suburb in the housing projects. What do you think?
I like it, yeah. But what's the conflict, though?
Yeah, there's no conflict. Oh my God,
mine has conflicts.
Yeah, you're... Yeah, okay. It does. Okay, yeah. Good. Well, I certainly hope that J-Fo, J-Ho, J-Lo, whatever they are, the two J's, they get together. Or maybe Jennifer Lopez could make an appearance in Grace and Frankie at some point.
Yeah.
No?
I still wouldn't watch it, I'm afraid. I don't find it funny.
All right, well, speaking of funny, our last film on the Jennifer Lopez trifecta is without question a bad film. But is it a bad film that is so baroque, so insane, and so out of this world in such an amazing way that it is next door to being a good film?
That's for sure.
And boy, did we enjoy watching it.
Oh yes, we did.
Look at our Twitter account at Broad Appeal Pod for a tease of what that film is.
Or just check out my sheets. See what state they're in.
We'll be back very soon with the final bit of Jennifer Lopez Crazy Loca.
Bye. You say that